This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Of course, last week we had a thought council at this time. And we were discussing media and, you know, media personnel, them being on Twitter, them being on Facebook, them sharing their views, the issues around digitization in South Africa and how, you know, that is affecting the business of doing news. And how do we gain credibility of those who give us the news? So I am going to be joined on the line by Zimasa Matiwane. She's a journalist at the Sunday Times. And of course, Kate Skinner, who has just left SANEF in the last few weeks or so. And she's now an independent media practitioner. And I should be joined on the line, hopefully, at some point by Sfiso Mahlangu, editor of the Star newspaper, to ably take this conversation forward and, of course, just delve a little deeper on these issues around the media. If the media doesn't talk about itself, then nobody will. And that becomes a crisis because it robs society an opportunity to focus on the media. And that line, if you want to join us, is 0861-987-000. And of course, you will hold on tight because we will be talking to the Auditor General of South Africa at 11 o'clock as well. So we've got a fully packed show for you today. And you can tweet me at @LukhonaMnguni, hashtag Power Talk. And I'm being informed that Sfiso Mahlangu has a few network issues, but I think they will be resolved. But meanwhile, let me welcome my guest, Zimasa. Good morning.
Good morning, Lukhona, and good morning to the Power FM listeners.
Kate, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
Excellent. Good morning to you and to the listeners.
Ah, thank you very much. Zimasa, let me start off with you. You are on social media. You are active on social media. When you are about to share a view, and you share quite a lot of views, do you think...
I do.
You do, because I follow you. You share quite a lot of views. When you share your views, do you ever think of balancing it with your work as a journalist and how some people might perceive you?
In fact, a lot of my views are in my outbox, in my draft. They don't go into the TL.
Oh, the real views.
The real ones. But look, in terms of how I conduct myself on social media, I try to, you know, apply the industry's traditional ethics and principles, especially how I relate to and how I interact with political commentary. So this often means that I'm extremely careful about what views I share, what I engage with, the sort of political content that I engage with, who am I following, who am I retweeting, what am I laughing at sometimes.
Yeah.
Even if I think it's funny, sometimes I can't, you know, even say lol to something that I think is funny if it has implications of painting me as someone who is, you know, affiliated to this party or this faction.
I mean, you talk about affiliation, and that's very interesting because one of the things that kept coming up last week was a question whether or not, you know, journalists have taken positions and sides. Do you ever take positions and sides on particular issues, and what guides your ability to take those positions?
I'm not politically affiliated. I must declare that straight up. I have my own politics. However, I've been fortunate enough that there has been no political party that I believe represents my politics or my interests. Therefore, I've never felt compelled to, you know, like so-and-so and not like so-and-so. Mm. But... Like I said, Lukhona, you see the thing with social media is that it's an extension of the job. It could be it might be my personal account. It might be, you know, my personal views. However, as a journalist in South Africa, especially seeing how deeply divided our country is along political lines, you have to be extremely careful in terms of what you say on social media. So that's basically how I try to conduct myself.
Yeah. Kate, I mean, you have had a global view of the media in South Africa, particularly those affiliated to SANEF. I know I'm not talking to you with that hat, but it has definitely enhanced your views and how you see issues. What are some of the things when you look at how journalists conduct themselves in the public, in the social media space, sharing opinions on what is happening in the country and still having the duty to report on those, that at times you feel these should be the do's and these should be the don'ts for journalists?
So absolutely. I think that, the issue is that, social media is extraordinarily powerful, and often people go there first to get their news. And journalists play an incredibly important role on social media. And I think that, you do have to be very careful as a journalist. You do need to look at what you put out there. And you have to realize that nothing is ever put out in your personal capacity. You can try to divide that and have your own personal account and then, also speak on behalf of your particular publication or broadcaster. But the fact is that you will always be seen as a journalist. And therefore, you do have to be incredibly careful. So you have to look at things like bias. You have to look at, not putting, if you've got a particular personal grudge, you can't put that personal grudge out there. You have to be very careful that you aren't seen to be supporting a particular political party, or even a particular if there's a huge controversy, a particular which is maybe religious or cultural, you can't be seen to be putting your view across unnecessarily on one particular side. But that's not to say that you can't have any opinions. And yeah, I think that's what is so tricky. And this would be true, of course, in publications and on broadcasters themselves, because there is news, and therefore you and with news, you've got to be very clear, very factual, make sure that different views are put across. But then there obviously are opinion pieces where you can be more kind of forthright in terms of what your opinions are. But what you've got to be very clear about there is that you make sure that people realize that this is the difference. This is an op-ed piece. This isn't news. And of course, it's very difficult for members of the public to kind of make those distinctions. And so we're always in that slightly kind of gray, murky area of, my opinion, and also trying very carefully, particularly if you're working with political news,
yeah,
to be not putting forward, I am pro this particular politician, this particular political party.
And of course, I mean, that being pro might not necessarily be pronounced, but at times you see how people may even talk to certain politicians in the social media space or in other spaces, and you feel there's a greater affinity to some politicians than others. What is it that, in those relationships, because those relationships are also important for stories, they're important for, getting inside views, even if you don't report on them and so on. How should you straddle that a tiny, delicate balance of, maintaining a relationship because it helps and you can be friendly with a politician, but making sure that it doesn't affect how you might report on certain politicians and organizations, Kate?
So you're absolutely right. There's this issue of the fact that obviously different, publications and broadcasters and will have a specific kind of political, views or a particular affinity to a particular political party or set of views. Maybe more, conservative or more left wing or more development focused or whatever. And so you're right. The politicians that are linked to that particular perspective, you might be more friendly to them than to politicians, from another perspective. But I think what is absolutely critical is that you must always ensure that what you're doing is you are always asking the hard questions, that you're always making sure that you're not letting someone off the hook, that you are getting to the bottom of whatever the matter is. And if there is a problem or corruption or mismanagement or not fulfilling particular, goals or perspectives or things that people have promised, that they're going to provide or deliver on, that you as a journalist are not letting them off the hook. You are making sure that they are answering the question. And so I think that's really critical.
Zimas, I mean, talking about continuously asking the hard questions, do you have any forms of, you know, I don't call them friendships, but being acquainted to certain political actors? And as a political journalist, at times you have been confronted with difficult choices in how you approach them. And what is it that you guard against in doing your work and being too friendly with people?
It's very difficult, Lukona, because you have to sort of maintain relationships. And for us, in newspapers, well, let me just say, for me, it's easy because I do not interact with the people that I have relationships with on social media. In fact, I do interact with political commentary, but I try not to interact with politicians directly. And the reason for that is that I don't want any sort of bias to come across, if there's any sort of bias. But also because for us in print, we survive a lot on people who are leaking us information. Therefore, when you are always seen tweeting so-and-so, being friendly with so-and-so, and the story comes out and, you know, you're quoting this anonymous sources, people think they know your friends in political parties. Therefore, they can put one and one together and say, okay, maybe it's this one who was leaking this, and, you know, for this objective, for these ends. And sometimes they could even be wrong. However, yes, to protect your sources, to protect your integrity, follow politicians, follow all of them from all political parties, because sometimes people pick up even who you follow, but try not to interact with them. I strongly believe that our online activity as journalists, speaking as a political journalist, it has an impact on our news outlet's public image. If you do something on Twitter and there's outrage, it will always reflect poorly on the publication that you work for more than it does on yourself. So for me, it's not only protecting my integrity and the job, because I can get fired if I'm being careless, but also protecting my employer and understanding that social media is not just a space whereby we just go and, you know, share how our day was and, you know, joke with our friends. It's now a significant channel of information and communication. Therefore, if I'm a professional in that sector, I have to kind of behave like I'm at work.
Yeah. In fact, that's an interesting point, because Kate, someone might argue, we're seeing some senior journalists saying they are leaving the social media platforms because they find them toxic and all of that. And in fact, I had the press ombud last week in the Thought Council, Pippa Green, and we spoke about how there seems to be an absence of putting policies in place by various media houses to guard, to sort of guide their journalists on how they should be handling themselves in that space. But I mean, let's leave the toxicity for a second. What are some of the policies you think that media houses should put in place without, of course, necessarily almost culling the freedom of speech and the freedom of expression of their own journalists as South African citizens?
So, yes. So I mean, I think that the Press Council has done a very good job in terms of putting out a social media usage policy. And I'm sure that Pippa Green probably talked about that. And so the policy is interesting because it isn't kind of cast in concrete. It's a set of guidelines. And the idea is that, you know, different media houses can take that, you know, those guidelines and then make it their own. So they could either, you know, adopt the policy as is, you know, with everything, or they could decide, you know, these are particular aspects that we want to adopt. And I think that it is incredibly useful. I mean, it looks at a whole lot of different things. So it looks at bias and personal matters. It looks at, you know, what you should do in terms of linking and friending, you know, what you should do in terms of confidential information, you know, all of those kinds of things. But what I do think is interesting about it all is a lot of it goes down to kind of common sense and professionalism. I mean, just what we've been talking about as part of this conversation, you know, are you, you know, how would you operate as a professional? Use your common sense about the fact that you would never, you know, put out something that is scurrilous. You wouldn't put out hate speech. You wouldn't get into a personal, you know, battle. You wouldn't put out something that you knew was confidential. Also, what is interesting is that there are particular guidelines around information about your own particular company. What would you put out about that? And saying that, you know, there are certain things about your own particular company that you wouldn't put out. For instance, the financial position of that company.
Yeah.
You know, if it's going to be sold or parts of it. You know, those kinds of things. Also, if you're working on a story and the story hasn't come out yet, you obviously as a journalist can't be putting it out before your publication or broadcaster puts it out. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that the social media policy covers. And I think it's very useful and a very good starting point.
Okay. I mean, the conversation with Zimasa Matiwane and Kate Skinner here on this Thought Council, part two, really, of considerations on how journalists should, you know, navigate the spaces that they find themselves in the social media spaces, even in society, and the limits, perhaps, of the views that they can put out. If you want to put some questions, and of course, if you want to have some comments, that line is 0861-987-000. Our WhatsApp line is always open for you to send short voice notes on 0833037093. And of course, you can tweet me at Lukona Mnguni, just like Sabelo Skidi just has done. And Zimasa, I think I'll give this to you because such an important question. He says, a point I'd like your panel to tease out. Journalists pay tax. Are they not allowed to have views on developments that affect their tax? Why can't they just be judged for their work? Very uncomfortable with the notion of pretending they are inhumane. How do you see it, Zimasa? You, a political journalist, certainly no doubt you like all of us, feel, you know, the money in the pocket is reducing, the tax is increasing, petrol is increasing, everything is going up. How do you handle that as a journalist? Do you want to say what you exactly feel about how the state is conducting itself?
What I've found with social media is that you, when you speak of governance, right, you can share opinions, you can say exactly how you feel. Everyone is feeling the pinch, you know, with salaries not going up, but the price is going up constantly. If you say something like that, I don't think there is anyone who can then turn it around and say, oh, so this means ABC. I almost feel like when you speak of politics and when you speak of governance, it's two different things. I think there's almost an obsession with impartiality. And that we must constantly be proving that, no, we have no opinion. And that's not easy because at the end of the day, we are South Africans before we are journalists. But I understand that I have to show that I am not biased. I can be objective. Mm. And of course, we all have opinions. But I think it's not enough to prioritize our agency sometimes, especially in an industry that suffers from so much, you know, trust issues.
Yeah.
You kind of have to tread carefully. If I say electricity has gone up and I'm struggling, I'm sharing my struggle. I'm being honest, and I know that it's something that everyone can feel.
Yeah.
But I cannot then have too many opinions on 30 days step aside.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain it, but I think I'm making sense. Do you understand?
No, I get you. I get you completely. And Kate, I want to pick up on that point of Zimasa because I traversed this issue quite a lot with my guests last week. The question around impartiality, I mean, she calls it too much obsession with impartiality. Do we misunderstand at times as a public what impartiality means or what objectivity means in how the media reports. And I talk about this because I often advocate for what I call a positionalist media. I don't mind if a media house tells me that its sole effort is to hold government accountable and that's it. So they'll always be polemic in how they report where government is concerned. I would love to hear that one day. Where are we in South Africa on some of these questions?
So these are the incredibly controversial questions, and they're not actually, you know, resolved pretty much, you know, anywhere in the world. I mean, you'll have certain kind of media that is, you know, absolutely determined that they want to be as impartial as possible and make sure that they aren't seen to be, you know, favoring a particular political party. And then they will, you know, and you know, particular countries that you know, have media that is, you know, more kind of dedicated to that. And then other countries where basically the idea is that, exactly as you've just said, you know, as long as you're absolutely clear, you know, this is a particular political party or a particular set of political views that we are openly, you know, supporting, then that's fine. You know, we're not trying to pretend, and, you know, everybody's got a view. So I think that's the problem, is that we haven't actually, as a media industry, you know, concluded that argument, and maybe that argument will never be concluded.
Do you think there's fear, Kate? Fear to conclude this argument or conversation in the South African political landscape?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, you probably have particular media houses that it's kind of particularly important that they have that more unbiased kind of set of principles. So, for instance, your public broadcaster, you would say that they would definitely need to make sure that all different political views were supported and put across. But obviously, you know, there are particular political parties that have a lot more support and others that have very small amounts of support. So there's always that kind of issue around equitable coverage, and that becomes particularly important in elections as well. So I think the thing that is critical for me is that what you're wanting to ensure is that even if you are saying very clearly, you know, we have a particular political perspective, you still have real integrity with that political perspective, because you're making sure that even though you're saying I support this set of politicians, this particular political party, I'm still not going to let them off the hook. I'm still going to ask them the hard questions. I'm still going to make sure that they deliver on what they say they're going to deliver on. And that way you ensure that you still have the credibility and integrity which the media needs.
Absolutely. Kate and Zimasa, please do stay on the line and hold that thought, Zimasa. I will be back with you. I just need to pay some bills. But if you also want to be part of this conversation, the line is 0861-987-000. And of course, continue to tweet me at LukonAmnguni, hashtag PowerTalk.
PowerTalk, 9 a.m. to noon.
Welcome back. It is just 27 minutes to 11 here on PowerTalk this morning with myself, LukonAmnguni. Of course, we are on Thought Council today. Unfortunately, I'm struggling to get my third guest, Sfiso Matlango. It seems as if his line is just terribly behaving this morning. But of course, you can be part of this conversation as well on 0861-987-000. And of course, I'm joined by Kate Skinner and Zimasa Matiwane. Zimasa, before we went on to news headlines, you just had a thought you wanted to share with us.
I said something about obsession with impartiality in passing, and I think I need to expand a bit on that. So what consumers, I believe, should be looking for in news is accuracy more than anything, and I believe that that is served by fairness more than the delusion of impartiality. And I think that people who consume the news focus too much on, are you impartial? Do you have an opinion? And they fail to account for the fact that we are not robots. We are people. We see things, we feel things, and we understand things in a particular way. But our duty as journalists then becomes to protect the industry and the integrity of the news by being aware of our own biases and considering those nuances in a manner in which we decide to tell a particular story. So I don't chase impartiality. I chase accuracy and fairness. I just needed to explain that.
No, absolutely. But, you know, Zimasa, someone might ask, if you write a story and it's laden with anonymous sources, how do I deal with the question of accuracy? Do I then take your integrity as a point to say this story must be accurate?
That's a difficult one, Lukona. So what you guys see in the paper is often maybe 10% of what we have been working on for the whole week. There are so many stories that do not come to the public, not because they are not true, but because of we are worried about the issue of trust, because we cannot prove ABC, because we only have anonymous sources, and you know, and so on. But with stories that have anonymous sources, I always try to balance that with someone who can speak on the record, not necessarily to confirm what everyone has said, but to put it into context in a manner that if you read the story, then you understand and you are able to believe because someone else is confirming this somehow. Let me make an example. When we broke the story about the King's Will, we had a lot of information from anonymous sources, people who are close to the situation, people who knew that the will had been read on Friday. However, we could not just say, this is what the will said and this is when it was read and leave it at that.
Yes.
And only quote anonymous sources. We had to find someone who is going to somehow confirm for us that yes, the will was read on the record. And even if they are not necessarily saying these were the contents of the will, and we're lucky enough to get Prince Buthelezi to say, yes, the will was read. No, I was not there. This is what happened. This is why I was not there. Then when you read it, it becomes believable. And, you know, that story is stands. It was accurate. And we worked very hard to maintain that sort of balance between anonymous and hear us out. We are telling the truth. And this is how we try to prove it to you.
Mm-hmm. Kate, I mean, this tugs at the heart of the question around the trust deficit that seems to be growing between the consumers of the media and the media, to a point that, you know, people will see things on the media and then still say the media is not making enough noise, the media is not reporting on this. And then you ask, but where did you hear it from? And then sometimes when they consume something, they look at the name of the reporter and they say, ah, no, that story, we know your agenda and so on. And of course, this led SANEF to, you know, deal with, I'll deal with that report at a different time, though, in its entirety, because I think it deserves its own show. But it is something that has concerned even the media itself, that there is a growing trust deficit, and this may also be affected by questions of ethical conduct or lack thereof from some journalists. How do you unpack some of these issues that are hurting trust on the media?
So it is an absolutely huge issue, and it isn't an issue only in South Africa. It's an issue across the world, and I think one of the big things to say about it is that you have these very high profile politicians such as Donald Trump, who went out of his way to keep on talking about, you know, the media being fake news,
yep,
fake, you know, and you've got a lot of populist leaders around the world, you know, who have done that and who've done enormous damage to the media. So I think, you know, So the external factors that have had, you know, a really negative and quite devastating impact.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the media itself as well, you know, make mistakes. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that's really tricky, because, you know, as the media industry, you know, shrinks, you know, as funding becomes more and more difficult, advertising becomes more difficult, newsrooms shrink, then, of course, you've got, you know, very small newsrooms and you know, a lot of stories and, you know, and a 24-hour news cycle and journalists having to put out stories on multiple platforms. So the pressure is absolutely enormous on journalists. So then there's that awful situation of the fact that sometimes, obviously, journalists are human beings, they'll make mistakes. So I think, you know, that was, you know, one of the major reasons why SANEF decided to do this whole inquiry into ethics, saying, you know, this is a key moment for us to pause. Where do we as journalists get things wrong? Where can we do better? And also to talk about that broader environment out there that is very toxic, very poisonous, very difficult to work in. And maybe a final thing to just say in terms of where ethics have really been kind of impacted on is, of course, social media, because, general public don't realize the difference between social media and the media itself. And, of course, on social media, you can say pretty much whatever you want to a lot of the time. Journalists can't, and people in professional positions shouldn't be saying, problematic things and unverified things on Twitter and Facebook, etc. But the thing is that, the general public does. So that impact of social media on the media has also had a really problematic impact. And I think we as journalists have to look at all of those different things. What can we do to make sure that we build back the credibility?
Yeah. I mean, Zimasa, I'm seeing some tweets, people saying, at times journalists are very emotional on social media. They're not patient. They're not engaging enough. And I'm taken back at times to you being at the heart of some storm, some social media storm because of a story that you had done on a bogus doctor down there in KZN. And how did you restrain yourself at times from responding in ways that you may have wanted to respond as an individual, as a person, but also as someone who feels your work is being hard done because the people that are lashing out at you are not appreciating the facts that you are putting across?
It was very difficult. I had to make a lot of decisions that I have never made without guidance. So everything that I did was by myself. I made my own decision. But I don't get emotional when people do that on the basis that, no, you guys should be, rather applauding me because I did ABC. I always feel like, look, it's the job. I get my salary. I don't need praise. So I'm fine with that. But the story came out on Sunday Times.
Yeah.
And whatever rebuffing that I was going to do was also going to be on a platform that is owned by my employer. So that was the first step, that rather focus on doing follow-up stories and not focus on Twitter, because I was never going to get anything done had I only, engaged on Twitter. It wasn't easy, especially when it relates to how other journalists were also part of the trolling, So I understand when ordinary people struggle to believe a story and interrogate it and sometimes bully you. It's fine, I understand. But when it's your colleagues who say, are you bringing shame to the industry and ABC and ABC, which was what was happening, then it starts to hurt. But because of how polarized our society is, not just the political space, actually, there are obviously a lot of dishonest people, and often they want information that affirms their biases and not the truth. So you need to understand, you need to give them space, you need to focus on doing work that is going to confirm that, in fact, what you reported was true. Otherwise, if you get into a pigsty, you're never going to come out.
That line is 0861-987-000. Donald, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
I'm very good, how are you?
Yeah, you know what? I think journalism as a profession also need to accept that their consumers have evolved to want to ask questions on the article. You cannot just put article and leave it at that. I only give an example. Kenya Hafati yesterday, not the day before, released an article where he's saying South African top thinkers want Adam Habib reinstated. What category did they use to arrive at saying someone is top thinker? Can you ask those questions, Ori? What do you mean, top thinkers? The reply she said was like, well, clearly we are not part of, we are not you are not fit to be a top thinker. So you think the problem comes exactly there. When you have arrogance in journalists, where when you went the accountability needs to be taken, where the articles are questioned, we are called trolls. You cannot call everyone trolls, especially if they're asking your work. We are asking, what about your work? What sense does this work make to you if you're going to say there are South African top thinkers? What category did you use? How did you arrive to say this one is a top thinker and Gudom Kopoti are just nobody?
Yeah.
How did you get to that? That is one thing that stands the credibility of South African media and the media at large.
Yeah.
We are having lots of people who are reporting biasly, and because they're journalists, they have pen and paper and the microphone, they think they can get away with things that are just not really appeared in the society. That is the problem.
Donald, thank you very much. Kate, I mean, that's a very important point that Donald is raising. It takes me back to a book written by Al Gore, An Assault on Reason. And basically, the part of the points Al Gore was making in that book is to say, media has changed, and the fact that there's greater propensity towards television robs the consumer of a sort of a two-way street of conversation, whereas with the newspapers, you would at least be able to write back a letter to the editor disagreeing with this story or that story or whatever. But now when we see with the digital media growingly, an article is put, and I mean, media houses have taken decisions not to open up for comment sections. At least here on radio, you know, we still have the opportunity to get this kind of feedback and be questioned in real time. But what happens when the consumer really, as Donald is suggesting, has evolved, wants to engage because the issue being put across by the journalist can't just get a free pass?
Yeah, so I think that's where social media plays its role, because, you know, that's the space where citizens can say, well, look, I don't agree with this. I don't think your particular view is a view that I support. The problem, of course, is that often those conversations become exceptionally toxic.
Yeah.
Instead of them being a kind of conversation which is about the ideas, you know, it can often become incredibly personal. I mean, female journalists often have a particularly rough time, you know, and things can get exceptionally bad. So the thing is that, you know, there's wonderful potential in social media in terms of that two-way conversation. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work in the best way because of the way that people operate. Mm. But I think that when it does work, it works fantastically because, you know, journalists know that they can't put something out and know that there's no comeback. You know, if something is controversial, then let it be controversial. Let people have the discussion and the debate and get all the different opinions out there. That potentially is very good for democracy when it works.
But I mean, of course, then there's this little risk of egos as well. And I've seen it, no doubt, as well on social media, where people are quick to say those who disagree are trolls or part of paid Twitter. I've been called paid Twitter myself by some very fairly senior people. And I think this is an assault on my thinking being, because actually what I just said is because I'm thinking it. So how do we do some training to motivate and cultivate this possible discussion platform by saying you can't just go around calling everybody you disagree with paid Twitter?
Look, I mean, I think that's what's very interesting about this social media policy that the Press Council has put out, because it does talk about that. It says, you know, you be professional. You know, don't you know, get into like slanging matches and kind of ugly battles. You're right. I mean, I think that it would be something that you'd have to work on over time. And the thing is that the journalists themselves, you know, also what's interesting about those kind of principles is that it says, you know, even though you might get horrible backlash and people being extremely ugly and extremely rude and toxic, the fact is you have to kind of rise above it. And I suppose that kind of thing, journalists have to kind of learn over time. And I think a lot of journalists do. I mean, they're very good at being able to deal with like exceptionally toxic exchanges and still maintain a kind of professional rise above it kind of attitude. And we just need to see more of that.
Zimasa, let us converse. The last theme that I have an interest on, how do you choose what to focus on? And as I said to my last guests, I understand you've got diary meetings, but as an individual, there may be those stories that you are passionate about, but how do you choose what you focus on, and how do you ensure that you don't lock out some of what may be more important conversations simply because you are not excited about them?
You mean in terms of
my the stories output. In terms of your output, what we get to see and consume on the newspaper.
Okay, so can you please repeat the question?
So how do you choose what to focus on, and the stories that you report, how do they come about, and how do you ensure that you manage to focus on the things that you may be passionate about, but also don't close out other important stories that society should know about?
Okay. So it's sort of like you don't allow mainstream to dictate to you what is important. And by that, I mean, if there's an NEC meeting, you are not compelled to focus on that all the time because there are other important things that are happening. So for me, it's always about putting the interests of the reader first. And although I cannot always sort of ignore what everyone else is talking about, I have to also find the obscure story that no one else cares about telling, or perhaps no one else has the resources, because I'm in a media house whereby I can do a lot of things that, you know, other people cannot be able to do. So it's, you can take a day, Lukona, and go to Msinga and find an amazing story and tell that story. And what I've often found is that people, the readers, appreciate that. Of course, they want to know what's happening at the NEC, but they also want to know what's happening in South Africa. And you must never neglect that. So that's sort of what guides me in terms of the output.
Kate, I mean, this question is important to me because at times you feel that the media can easily become an echo chamber. We just talk about the same things. You switch on here, you switch off there, you read here, you read there. It's almost like there was a a media gathering to say, this is what we deal with. What do you think are some of the pressures that are facing the media in terms of, you know, I do find a little struggle in differentiating content that is out there. It's almost as if the same content is circulating. Have we lost something along the way?
So that is an incredibly important question, and it's around the diversity of content. And then, of course, it goes to the issue of, do we have enough publications? Do we have enough, you know, small broadcasters? Do we have enough media in all those small towns and in rural areas? You know, or do we have a situation rather where, you know, the big metropoles are the areas where the media is based and where all the stories come from? And so then we just literally don't know what's happening in a whole lot of small towns, and often a huge amount of abuses, poverty, all kinds of, and of course, fascinating, intriguing, amazing stories are all happening out there, and we literally don't know about it. And so I think what is absolutely critical is that we start to look at, you know, community media and media in these other areas. And one of the interesting things that I was looking at when I was part of SANEF, and of course, you know, the management committee at SANEF was looking at this, was the idea of twinning, of looking at, you know, some of the small media that does exist in these small towns and other areas, you know, literally feeding stories and information to some of the big players like the Sunday Times, the Arena Publications, the SABC, etc., and saying, you know, how do we build each other? Some of the big players build the little players, and the little players also support the big players, and that kind of level of cooperation in our industry, and then also goes to issues around funding. I mean, is there, and the importance of, kind of, for instance, and this is also very controversial, but like public funding, government funding going into supporting community media, so for instance, that they are stronger more able to get those other alternative stories. So I think those are all the kinds of things that we need to look at, because that is what really nurtures democracy, when you've got a fantastic view as to like what all our citizens are saying, thinking, believing and feeling about our politics and what is happening in South Africa.
You are raising something so important, and probably a very, very vast area where we talk about community media, because in some instances, the criticism has also been that you'll find the community radio station is even housed in a building owned by the local municipality, and that really affects its independence and its ability to deliver to residents or citizens in that particular locality on the true state of governance in that particular municipality. How far are we in trying to re-identify or recapture the independence of community media, Kate?
So you, raise an important issue. I think one of the biggest things is that when you have a media industry which is under huge pressure, and particularly financial pressure, it does impact on independence issues. And it's exactly what you're saying. You know, if a community radio station has is housed at a municipality and dependent on that municipality, you're quite right. I mean, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them to really hold the mayor and various key officials accountable, and so we do need to look at those issues very, very clearly and put a major focus on it. I mean, of course, there are agencies such as the Media Development and Diversity Agency, and their whole purpose is to support, fund, etc., community media. So I think that particularly now, I think COVID was really devastating for the community media. I mean, any media that was not doing particularly well or particularly strong before COVID, was impacted particularly badly during COVID. Mm. And so I think the focus now from government, but also from donors, from the corporate sector as well, to put funding and support, capacity building, etc., for community media, it is absolutely essential and definitely needs to be a focus moving forward.
Zimasa, probably an almost parting shot. The first place I visited where there was a lot of media was probably the NASREC 2017 policy conference. Mm. And I mean, we have been to local government election result centers and so on. But you stay there in the media center for long hours. There's nothing happening. There's no briefing. So, and then, it showed me there's a lot of a buddy-buddy system in the media. So people really are colleagues and they're friends and they get along. Do you think this ever affects at times the way you approach work, or influences the stories that eventually get some focus and taking away from, that sense of gaining space to pursue other stories?
So I don't know about other people. However, yeah. my approach to journalism and news is never collaborative. In any sense of the word. I'm not taking a heads up from you regarding story A and story B, because I don't have capacity to vet your biases. Mm. So I'm a loner when it comes to how I approach my work. I'm not also too exposed to who is friends with who. My friendships in the media are personal, and they are not any way related to the work that I do.
So in that instance, then the friendships are just personal. They stay there, and you probably even in your circles try not to discuss news as much as possible.
No. We talk news, we talk politics, but not in a way that seeks to influence the other person in how they conduct themselves and how they do their work. But in a way that look, Lukoda, it's journalism is very frustrating. You have a front seat row to the theater of destruction in South Africa. Therefore, you need to offload often to your colleagues, who are the few people who know beyond, what is out there in the media, what is happening behind the scenes. Mm. So you need those sorts of relationships, but they must not influence how you do your work. That's what I'm saying.
Front seat row to the theater of destruction. Kate and Zimasa, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That brings an end to Thought Council this morning. That was part two of the discussion just on media, because there was just so much of a call. No, more is needed on this. Let us cover more issues. I hope now, between last week and this week, we have almost captured the true essence of the conversation. And of course, as time goes by, we will keep on having these discussions. It is 11 o'clock here on Power Talk this morning.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.